Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Before my guests on today's show scored a pair of Oscar nominations for writing Judas and the Black Messiah, they may have been best known for this scene in a little movie called 22 Jump Street.
I don't know, at the end of the day, you just kind of want something that's just a little deeper, really.
Yeah, balls deeper. Jinx bought me a coke. Oh, snap, man, we're still saying the same thing. This is amazing. Carrots, pumpernickels, glow sticks, twins.
This is The Last Laugh. I'm Matt Wilstein from The Daily Beast, and today on the show, we have our very first set of comedian twins, the Lucas Brothers. Keith and Kenny Lucas have a fascinating story that started in the Newark Projects, includes dropping out of two separate law schools to become a stand-up comedy team, and culminates this month at the Academy Awards, where they are nominated for Best Original Screenplay for co-writing Judas and the Black Messiah. Their deeply conflicted feelings about Hollywood ended up being a big theme of this conversation, and I really think you're going to enjoy it. Oh, and after 106 episodes, I may have finally stumbled upon a name for the ever-evolving segment that ends every episode of the show. So definitely stick around for that as well. But now, here's me with the Lucas Brothers. Well, first of all, I just have to congratulate you guys on the Oscar nominations. It's incredible. It's very exciting. I saw you, I think it was on Instagram, you posted that you are the only six comedians before you guys nominated for screenplay nominations. So that's pretty exciting.
Yeah, it's a remarkable history because I'm a student of history and I love stand-up so much, and just it's crazy that, you know, we're part of something that's never been really done before. So it's crazy.
It's not in the same category, but you are there's also in the adapted screenplay category two previous guests on this show, Sacha Baron Cohen and Jenna Friedman for Borat. So at least you don't have to go up against them, but some fellow comedians in the mix.
Right. This might be the most in 1 year that so many stand-up comedians have been nominated for. It's kind of remarkable.
Very cool. Well, I'm such a huge fan of Judas and the Black Messiah. It was really one of my favorite movies of the year, if not my favorite movie. And I was just thrilled that it got so many nominations, including for you guys. But let's just start at the beginning. I mean, how did you guys get involved in this movie? How did this happen?
I mean, we have a pretty deep history with Fred Hampton. In college, we came across his story in an African-American studies course. And, it always just kind of hit us kind of hard. And so when we got into entertainment, we were just sort of like tinkering around with an idea, and then we came across William O'Neill's story, and we were like, oh man, this could work as a film. So we went around town, pitched the idea, and got a bunch of rejections, and not always just rejections, but they just didn't get the idea, didn't think it was very marketable or, you know, whatever. And so we hooked up with Shaka while we were doing an FX pilot. He was directing, we were acting in it, and we kind of hit it off. And
I wouldn't call that acting.
No.
Yeah, we were reading lines and trying our best. Shaka was doing his best with our acting ability, but we became friends, and we felt very comfortable going to him with our idea, and we pitched it to him, and he fucking dug it, and then the rest is history, man.
Do you think that some of the resistance that you were facing had to do with the fact that you are known as comedians, and that this is, you know, not a comedic story?
Oh yeah, I think I'm sure there was some apprehension on behalf of from other executives, because we were comedians, and you know we were known,
and we're not just comedians, like we're comedians who smoke weed and should we trust them with $20-something million?
I mean, do we want to give them the keys?
Yeah, when you call your special on drugs, you're kind of setting
exactly,
yourself up for that.
You're not being subtle. So yeah, I'm sure there was a lot of apprehension. And rightfully so. And also, this was our first time pitching a movie like this to the industry, so we weren't great at it. We weren't the best at pitching.
It was a comedy of errors, essentially. but the best decision we made was hooking up with Shaka, man. That was
right.
Yeah,
he's one of the best. I think he's one of the best out right now. And you know, we were fortunate enough to. Just to get that opportunity to work with him and to realize like, oh yeah, he's the person that's going to get us over the hump. And it's worked out perfectly.
Yeah. I mean, you said you're familiar with Fred Hampton's story for a long time. You have this comedy background, but you also have, you know, you both started law school. So do you feel like that experience, even that limited experience, informed your ability to really dig into this story at all?
Oh yeah. I think law school, I mean, as much as I hated law school, it made me a much more principled researcher. I love footnotes because of law school. Law school made me love footnotes.
That was the best thing about law school, just the appreciation of the footnote. Footnotes, I mean, you get so many great stories from footnotes. Sorry for cutting you off.
Right, I mean, Mank got his own movie and 10 Academy Award nominations. I wouldn't say he's a footnote, but you know, he's a footnote in reference to Orson Welles. So it's like, yeah, that kind of like mentality of looking for like those small stories, I think I got from law school. And I would say that helped us find William O'Neill's story, for sure.
Yeah, I mean, so that's sort of the other side of the coin. If you knew about Fred Hampton, then when did you find out about Bill O'Neill and decide that he was going to be such a big part of the story?
So we found out about Bill, I think it must have been around 2012, 2013. So, you know, when you learn about Fred Hampton, you learn like some key moments, key beats of the story. You know the FBI was involved with his assassination, but you don't really know like the details. So we started reading this book, The Assassination of Fred Hampton. I think that was written by Jeffrey Haas. We started reading that around 2012, 2013. And there were a couple pages dedicated to William O'Neill. And his story just, I don't know, we read it a few times and it just like sparked intrigue immediately. We just started thinking, wow, this kind of feels like an espionage film. You know what I mean? We started to think about drama when we were thinking about his story. And then we tried to do more research, try to find anything we could on him. It wasn't a lot. A couple articles about him in a newspaper just talking about his death. But then there was a transcript that we found of the Eyes of the Prize interview. So the interview that's featured in the film, we found that transcript, I think, around 2013. And we read that transcript so much. And we were like, yeah, this is the making of a film. This is a crime thriller. Just the way he described the story, how he got recruited, how he infiltrated, just the social political context, how he described it during the time and his admiration for Fred Hampton. It was just a lot in there that we felt could work as a film.
Yeah, I mean, the film's been described as radical. And I think to me, what makes it so radical is the fact that it is this compulsively entertaining crime thriller that anyone, whether you're interested in this subject matter or not, is going to find entertaining. And then through that, you're getting all these ideas in there. So was that something that you guys really thought about? Like, we want to make this appealing to a wide audience? Because you could see there could be plenty of versions of the Fred Hampton story that wouldn't be as broadly appealing to as wide of an audience.
Right. I mean, I think we had two intentions, and I don't want to speak for Shaka, but I've seen him say this. I mean, yeah, we wanted to make a film that people watched. I mean, I think that that's a part of the compromise that you make when you're doing art. This is a business and you want it to reach as many people as possible. But in that intention, there was also an intention to ensure that we properly represented Fred's message so that the film does work as a sort of didactic, you know, piece of art where you can learn something.
Yeah, I mean, and a lot of people have been able to see it, you know, especially because it ended up on HBO Max, I think, which you know, I'm sure there's some mixed feelings about that in terms of it being a movie that you imagined being in the theaters and then ended up on this streaming service. But I think there is something positive about it, and that it got to probably a lot of people that may not have, you know, seeked
Without
it out
doubt.
In the theater otherwise.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think HBO Max played a large role in allowing for people who probably wouldn't have gone to the theater to see it, to watch it. And, ultimately, that's a good thing. We want a lot of people watching the film by any means necessary.
Yeah, I was wondering if you guys started hearing from people the morning of the Oscar nominations when it had disappeared from HBO Max. Like, what happened?
Yeah, no, it was excellent timing on the part of Warner Bros.
Yeah, that was weird. I don't know what was happening there.
I'm sure they weren't expecting the 6 nominations.
Someone didn't think that through.
I think it's something they learned in business school. It's like counterintuitive marketing. It's some Harvard Business School stuff where they take the product away during the height of its advertising. So
yeah, it's true. I wonder. Yeah, true. Maybe they didn't expect it to do so well at the Oscars.
well, maybe not. I don't know.
I mean, it could also be a calculus where it's like, oh, we still have it in theaters. Maybe this will incentivize people.
Right. I think that was probably the idea, but for a lot of people, I'm sure it was like, hey,
I just heard about this movie right now. But hopefully, like, once it comes back on HBO Max, that'll be around the time the awards are taking place. So
yeah,
it'd be another good opportunity.
I think the Academy has a portal where they can watch the movie anyway, so we don't have to worry about Academy members. The Academy members are taking
care
of
it. They'll find it. The other, you know, obviously huge surprise Oscar morning, probably the thing that got the most attention was the, you know, double nomination for Lakeith Stanfield and Daniel Kaluuya in Best Supporting Actor. And, you know, the joke that morning was kind of like, wait a minute, if they're both, they're in the title of the movie and they're both supporting actors, then who's the lead of this movie? So now that I have you guys, the writers of the movie, I have to ask you, who's the protagonist of this movie if they're both supporting?
I say it's a hero's journey for capitalism.
Capitalism wins the day.
Capitalism wins at the end of the day. So I would say capitalism is the lead.
Yeah. I think it's an ensemble piece, but I think it's told through the perspective of William O'Neill. So he's our main character. The lead supporting thing is a sort of an artificial distinction created by awards organizations. So sometimes we superimpose that on how we're supposed to do narratives, and it becomes a de facto way we see storytelling. But it's an artifice.
Yeah, I mean, Lakeith seemed confused as well about how he ended up in supporting actor.
It all comes down to language. Like, these concepts aren't clearly defined. So people, you know, like Kenny said, they sort of superimpose it on. They superimpose that language on how we describe watching a film. And it's like, you know, ultimately, a nomination is a nomination. So
I would argue, who framed Roger Rabbit? Who's the lead in that movie, right? Like, is it Roger Rabbit, or is it Bob?
Or is it the guy who framed him?
Is the guy who did the framing? Like, who? Like, is the villain the institution that's the protagonist? I don't know. They were all sort of supporting this larger narrative that we were trying to tell. So I can see the argument why they are our supporting characters. But
if they had nominated Martin Sheen as best lead actor, then then you would know there was a problem.
Now that would have been a big surprise.
That would
be a shocker. Yeah, I mean, both of them, though, the two leads, in my opinion, of the movie are unbelievable. And I mean, you couldn't have asked for two better actors in this movie. Starting with Daniel Kaluuya, what were your sort of for when you saw him do it for the first time? What were your first impressions of seeing him embody this character?
It was at the table read, right? So there was a table read. I think it was in September. It was the first table read of everybody, like everyone was involved. And Kaluuya, I mean, you know, he came in. He wasn't like, he was low key, wasn't talking much, sort of like in his own headspace. And so, you know, I didn't know what was about to happen. I was just like, all right, it's a table read. Normally when people go to table reads, you know, you go, you kind of go through the motions just to get a feel for it, and you move on with your life. But on this particular table read, like, Kaluuya went to another level. Like, it was like an alien from outer space. We were watching something that I don't think I've ever, it was the greatest, I would say it's the greatest table read performance I've ever seen.
Let's just say I felt like I should have, like, paid to see that. Like, I was like, I gotta pay this guy because he's going above and beyond for us. And I'm like, he doesn't have to go this hard. You already got the part. You know what I mean?
Right.
It wasn't an audition.
Like, yeah, but it felt like he was auditioning for his life. You know what I mean? Like, whether or not, like, if he didn't get the part, he was going to get murdered at the end of it. Like, it was so brilliant. It was one of the greatest things I've ever seen. And I didn't know that. I read a story recently that, like, $1 million was on the line in terms of increasing production for that table read. So, like, the stakes were even higher. Like, I didn't even know all this. I just, and I don't think Kaluuya knew either. Yeah. He was just giving it his all. and he delivered it. I mean, it was otherworldly. And after that table read, I was like, oh yeah, this is going to be something that's going to shock the world, because it was remarkable. It was like Fred Hampton was in the room. It was utterly remarkable.
The scene in the movie, the really big, you know, powerful speech that he gives is one of the most, you know, sort of chilling, incredible acting performances that I've ever seen. So what about that when you saw it then on film? I don't know if you were on set for that, what was that like?
We had the great fortune of being on set to witness that scene. And it blew my mind, man. Like, I was there and you just hear the background actors and he's delivering his lines, but it doesn't feel like he's acting. It feels like we're really caught up and swept up into the moment. Like, I mean, I got chills and I was just like clapping afterward. This is, you know, I've seen this before. I've acted in film before. This isn't anything new to me, but it felt so.
Again, I wouldn't call what different. We've done acting. you use that term so.
You're right. I apologize. But I'm used to the atmosphere. Yeah. The atmosphere. Right. I'm familiar with it.
Right, right.
The only other time I've seen acting like that, honestly, we got to see Will Smith during Bad Boys, and he goes to they just go to another level, and they just embody the spirit of the role, and they just turns into something totally different.
It was almost like, it felt like I was at the best version of a stand-up show. From a civil rights preacher. Felt like we were in the 60s and we were listening to Fred Hampton's speech.
In terms of capturing his ability to capture the crowd and just change the energy in the room.
Yeah, I mean, that was the energy that we were playing with, and it was overwhelming.
And he gave the same level of energy to each take. Like, he never like changed his inflection, or you never got the sense that he was tired or that,
how many times, you know, did he have to do that speech?
It was multiple takes. I mean, because, you know,
it was all day, right? I mean, that was right. An all
it was,
day
it was
shoot.
A, it was a long shoot. That's because insane. It was so much coverage. I mean, that's such a complex scene. You got to get Deb, you got to get Lakeith, you got to get Jesse, you got to get all Fred, you got to get the background actor. So like, there's such a complex scene, and it was a tough one. But you know, you can feel the energy just by watching it. So imagine being there and sitting there and feeling it. It was just like, it was. And then after the first one, he got a standing ovation. And it was like, people were just like, oh, we know that we're experiencing something that's going to be remembered throughout time. It was remarkable.
A question of violence or non-violence. It's a question of resistance to fascism or non-existence within fascism. You can murder a liberator, but you can't murder liberation. You can murder a revolutionary, but you can't murder revolution. And you can murder a freedom fighter, but you can't murder freedom.
So let's talk about Lakeith a little bit too. And that character of Bill O'Neill is, you know, I would say one of the more complex protagonists in a film ever.
Right.
And just sort of understanding where he's coming from and just why he did what he did, which is, you know, something that you guys had to think about a lot, I'm sure, writing it. So how do you think about him as a real person, Bill O'Neill?
I'm so obsessed with 70s cinema, and you think about protagonists in Taxi Driver, you think about the protagonists of The Conformist. They're these guys who are, you know, wrapped up into this sort of system that's completely oppressive, and they feel like they have no out. They feel like they have no sort of freedom to make their own choices, and they're just sort of like trapped. And I felt like when I read about William O'Neill, I was getting those vibes. I really wanted to I wanted it to feel like it was an existential for him. Like, he's struggling with his identity. He's struggling with poverty. He's struggling against this sort of, he's struggling with this false scene deal that he made with the FBI to take down someone who's just great. And I feel like Lakeith, man, like, that guy can act, man. He is a phenomenal, just Pacino, De Niro, like those guys. He's on that level, and he captured the feelings of angst that I felt was going to make this movie different from everything else that we've seen before. We're not dealing with the traditional, you know, civil rights hero. We're dealing with someone who people despise, but we're giving him an arc, and we're saying this guy matters too. Like he existed just as much as Fred, and he was manipulated by forces bigger than him, just like Fred. Obviously, Fred made a much larger sacrifice, but I don't think you can ignore his story.
Right. I mean, I feel like the juxtaposition between the two just makes for a very, very powerful storytelling. You know, I think you better understand Fred by understanding Will. You better understand Fred's willingness to die for his beliefs by seeing a person who was unwilling to die for his beliefs. You know what I mean? And I think it's that juxtaposition that makes the story really, really compelling. And Lakeith, I mean, he, Kenny said, or he already said a lot of it, but just like his nuance as an actor, just like sometimes he'll say so much without saying anything at all. Just using his eyes or a little like glance over to the side says so much about a character by not saying anything at all. And that's just a testament to his ability to capture what we were doing with the themes, but just through facial expressions. I mean, he's a remarkable actor. And him and Kaluuya together, I mean, it's like you're getting two of the best actors of their generation sharing the screen. I mean, it was just such a moment being able to watch them together.
Yeah, Lakeith is someone who's also done, you know, comedy and drama and does both so well. Were there moments in the script where you did try to kind of sneak a little bit of comedy in or moments of levity? Or was that just not even sort of part of what you were trying to do?
Well, you know, Burson and King, and Shaka, you know, they also come from...
Yeah, Will Burson was your co-writer, yeah.
He was a co-writer, and Shaka King also, they also come from a comedy background as well. There is a lot of dry wit throughout the film, and Lakeith had to improvise that scene when he's speaking to George Sams. Just that reaction to Sams, which was kind of comedic. I know people laughed in the theater, but I think that was improvised. And
then we had Jermaine Fowler and we had right. Morrell, and they were playing serious roles. But to me, it's always funny when you see great comedic actors do something that's a little bit different. I think it's
and Jesse Plemons has performed in a comedic space as well. So there was just a lot of comedic aspects to the film, from all of the writers dabbling in comedy to a lot of the performers coming from a comedic background. And so, like, again, it's very dark and very, very, very dark wit, I think, throughout the film. I find myself laughing at moments when I probably shouldn't laugh, but maybe
like what?
Because I'm a comedian.
Can you think of a moment that made you laugh?
So when Hoover is talking to Plemons or Roy Mitchell, and they do a flashback to George Sams laughing. You know, they show him again, like, you remember George Sams, and they flash back to George Sams and he's laughing. I laugh at that all the time. But I don't know why I think that's funny.
It just makes me laugh. I like the scene where they're like, when it's Jesse and Hoover, Mitchell, and the other character, and they're just like going back and forth about his daughter. I mean, I always like find that they're like, that's such an insane conversation to have.
Right.
It's not that's like laugh dark. Out loud funny, yeah. But it's so, it's to me, I find it humorous.
Yeah. So we're talking, you know, now a few weeks before the Oscars. Do you guys know how it's going to work yet in terms of like, because I know there's sort of like this no Zoom rule that went out.
Yeah.
And are you planning on being there in person, or do you know how it's going to work?
So there was a meeting, I think yesterday, actually, with all the producers, and they were basically trying to describe what it's going to be like. And I think that it's going to be somewhat outdoors and somewhat indoors, limited capacity at this place at Union Station, which is downtown LA. And it's like we're going to be rotating. So because you can only have a certain number of people indoors at a certain time. So I think it might be capped at like 100. I could be wrong. But whatever that number is, that's going to be inside. And then you're going to have, there's going to be two outdoor areas, and we're going to be rotating throughout the night. And they encourage everyone who lives in the States they want everyone to be there who've been nominated. But they're setting up satellite shows for people in other countries if they can't make it to LA.
Like, is Daniel going to be in London, or do you know, is he?
That's a great question.
He's in New York now, right?
Oh yeah, because he's doing SNL. So. Yeah, I think he's going to be there.
That's cool. Yeah, that's wild. I mean, to have your first Oscar experience be this very strange Oscars is unusual.
I think. Yeah, I mean, it makes it more iconic.
So the Lucas brothers do everything together. But not too long ago, they almost split up as a comedy duo. We get into that and a lot more coming up next.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad. And I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
If you're enjoying this episode, please hit subscribe. As I mentioned at the top of the episode, the Lucas brothers are not the only Oscar-nominated comedians we've had on this show. There are incredible conversations in the Last Laugh archive with Sacha Baron Cohen and former Daily Show producer Jenna Friedman, who are both nominated for Best Adapted Screenplay this year for writing Borat's subsequent movie film. By subscribing to The Last Laugh, you can listen to those episodes and everything else from our free archive, and you'll be the first to hear new episodes when they drop every Tuesday. And while you're at it, please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts to let us know how much you love the show and who you want to hear next. Now, back to the Lucas brothers. So I do want to talk about your comedy, because this is a comedy podcast. And to just really go back to the beginning of that, when did you start doing stand-up, and specifically this idea of doing stand-up together, which is unusual to have, you know, two twins on stage together, kind of working off of each other, finishing each other's sentences, and then give a very unique style. When did that start?
We started doing stand-up in 2010. Well, our first gig was 2009. Eastville Comedy Club. This was Eastville in Manhattan before we went to Brooklyn. So we did a quick 2 minute spot at this open mic, and it was we had like four people in the audience, and it was bad, man. It was some of the worst comedy. I wouldn't even want to call it comedy.
Yeah, you wouldn't classify that as comedy.
No.
Yeah, it was. we didn't really have a sense of style or a sense of what we wanted to say or how we wanted to say it. It was chaos. And but it was exhilarating. It was like, you know, you step on stage that first time, and it was unlike any feeling I've ever felt ever. And you know, it's one of those things where like I knew we weren't good, but I knew that it was something that I loved, and that it was something that I was going to commit myself to.
Yeah. So even though it didn't go well, there was something about it that kept you coming back.
Right. You know, you can't stop thinking about it. You know, I don't want to say it's like a drug, but it's certainly like an addiction that you get just being on stage and feeling that energy and connecting with people and hopefully getting laughs. I mean, yeah, it's unlike any feeling in the world.
Holding that microphone in your hand, like.
Right. Right.
It's nuts.
And then we get to do it, and we get to do it together, right? So it's like it's an otherworldly experience. I'm on stage with another person, trying to get these people to laugh, but also trying to get my brother to laugh. And you know, we have to make sure that we're in sync, and that you know, we're it's like a dance with us, but it's also a dance with the audience. And it's always, for me, it's always like a beautiful experience to go through.
Was there a moment or a show that it felt like it clicked for the first time, the way that you were able to work together on stage?
I think
the show that made me realize we had a decent act was 2019 Montreal. That was the show.
That's pretty recently.
I was ready. I know, because in my mind, 2019. Like, I was like, that's when I was like, all right, it's getting better. Like, it was, we were just on fire, man. Like, that, the audience was just like with us. It was a large show. Like, how many people? 5,000, maybe? That many people?
Wait, which one are you talking about? You're talking about the gala?
The gala, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it's very recent. At 3,000. Very recent. It's like, we had this. Right before COVID, you know, we were going to the Cellar every night. You know, we were doing, you know, three shows a night and just crushing, you know, just like, you know, really, really crushing and really like, but not like overthinking, you know, just it almost felt like, I don't want to say second nature, but it just felt like I normally when I get on stage, I overthink. I think way too much. But right before COVID, when we were just at the Cellar that week, I think that was when I was like, oh, yeah, we're starting to piece it together. We're starting to figure this out.
And we hosted a show for Rami Youssef. It was Rami, Mike Babiglia, a bunch of
Dave
was there. It was a bunch of just like heavy hitters, and I was like, damn, I love this shit. Like I was like, I can do anything now. Like I can host if I wanted to. I used to have an apprehension about hosting because our style was so laid back. I was like, well, can we maintain the energy for an hour? Like, can we do it? But when we did it with that show, I was like, we're getting to a point where I'm like, I feel real comfortable with this.
Right. We needed to break free from the laid back that style, which I think, you know, was something that we gravitated toward because we felt like it would be, it would be easier to present our ideas. But I think once we started speaking like we normally speak, it's made stand up much more fun for me.
You feel like you were almost doing like characters on stage before that?
Essentially.
It was character work. It felt almost like it was like Hannibal Light. Like I saw Hannibal. I was like, he's cool, laid back. I kind of want to be like that. But it's like,
was he someone who you looked up to or tried to emulate?
He was a huge influence.
Hannibal, I mean, Burris.
We were doing stand up one way in Jersey. Awful, terrible, terrible stand up. And we got to New York and went to Brooklyn, and it was 2010, right? 2010 October, we went to Brooklyn. Went to Brooklyn for the first time and went to the Knitting Factory, and we were like, holy shit, like this is the new stand-up. This is like, we've evolved beyond Chris Rock and Dave Chappelle, and this is like this is the new revolution of Black comedy. And you see Hannibal for the first time, and I instantly had that thought. And we knew we needed to be in Brooklyn if we wanted to evolve as stand-up comedians, because that's where everything was happening. I mean, Hannibal was there, you know, Glover was there, Kat Barnett was there, Eric Andre was there, Che was there, like Phoebe Robinson. It was just so many eclectic, different kinds of voices all in Brooklyn, and we knew immediately we needed to be there.
So you said you felt like you were just sort of breaking through in, you know, 2019 before COVID. You had your special that we mentioned, On Drugs, you know, came out a couple years before that, right? So how do you feel about that special now? I mean,
I feel like it's inauthentic. I mean, I'm happy. I think it was a step in the right direction. You know, I feel like if it wasn't for On Drugs, I don't think we'd do a lot of shit happened as a result of it, and it was necessary. And I think it was a good, step forward, but I don't think it's our most authentic voice. I don't think we're our most comfortable.
And we thought we were gonna get shot. Yeah.
Fortunately enough, he didn't kill us.
No.
He just wanted a selfie.
That's all he wanted.
Just wanted to take a selfie. Saw us in 22 Jump Street, liked us, asked for a picture. He's actually a pretty cool cop. Pretty cool. So we took the picture with him because he had a gun. Snapped it, and then he flew away on his horse.
Yeah. Right?
as he's flying away, we had an epiphany. Mm-hmm. You see, we realized how to solve the problem of police brutality. You just got to give every black dude a 2 to 5 minute cameo in a movie with Jonah Hill and Channing Tatum.
Or Seth Rogen.
He works too. And it worked. Because black lives matter. They do.
They matter.
They fucking matter.
They fucking matter.
But in America, black cameos matter a little bit more. We were going through a very weird time in our relationship during that period too. And you, like, we weren't really like talking. We were kind of arguing. We were on the brink of breaking up. So a lot of it was
a lot of tension between the Lucas Brothers. between 2016 and 2018, I mean, we were just like, I just think we had different like goals, I guess. I mean, I was kind of ambivalent.
How would you describe
about, like,
that?
After 22 Jump Street, like, things got a little weird, you know, because you get a little bit of fame and it kind of threw us off our initially stated goals, which was like, we want to be the best stand-ups that we can be. And we just want to be the best stand-ups that we can be. But once you get a little bit of fame, it's like, I don't know, for me at least, it pushed me away from that. Because like, you can't observe anymore. Before as a comedian, when no one knows who you are, you can exist on the margins. You can observe and you can report and you can sort of, but then once you get a little bit of fame, you start to lose a little bit of your privacy. And I don't know, I wasn't going out as much and I kind of became a bit more like, I don't know, just in my own head. And I think it fucked up my stand-up and it fucked up my approach to stand-up and it fucked up my passion for stand-up. But I think that, you know, going through that, being able to like confront a couple of the demons that I needed to confront, I actually grew as a stand-up comedian. You know what I mean? Because after we rejected Hollywood and, you know, or left Hollywood and got back to New York, it was like we were completely focused on our stand-up. But I think you need to go through like obstacles to grow. Yeah, that Hollywood phase was just wild.
Kenny, did you feel like you were embracing the Hollywood side a little more?
No, I mean, the reality of the situation is Hollywood for me was always sort of a means to an end. Like I wanted to use Hollywood as a way to, you know, get better gigs and to, you know, secure my spots in theaters and stuff like that. Hollywood was a mechanism to advance my stand up. But when we secured 22 and it came out and it was successful and we got all that fame and all that shit like that, like, yeah, you get attracted to it and you start to think that's who you are, that you're this celebrity and you might be better than people or you deserve shit, and you start to lose yourself real quick. And I think going to Hollywood and being around it made me realize how much I didn't like it and how much I was like, that's just not my style. I got into stand-up for a reason. I love film. I don't really like all of the other stuff. I feel like for me, that shit just gets ugly, especially like with drugs and alcohol. Like, my body's not built for it and I'm like susceptible to that shit. And in Hollywood, it's just sort of a part of the culture. So you can easily lose yourself in all that shit. And I had to do some like deep soul searching to pull myself back from the ledge. It was ugly, man. It was ugly.
It's kind of wild to hear you guys talk about even the idea of breaking up because you know, have done everything together for so long and you're so, you know, thought of as this, as a team. Do you ever feel like doing everything together, you know, risks losing any of your individuality?
I mean, yes and no. I feel like what's crazy is that, like, despite being known as a twin and being in such a, you know, a seemingly codependent relationship, I do feel like I do have a lot of individuality. Like, I think, like, when you do get to know us, you realize, oh yeah, that's Keith and that's Kenny. I think, you just got to spend time with us and you'll notice that there are some differences between us and that we do have our own individual tastes and we have our own individual lives. I mean, we commingle, we work together, we do a lot of things together, but I think now there is a healthy space between us and that we're not as... not as codependent as we used to be.
You say that, and I'm literally right above you in our apartment. Literally, just right above.
Do you guys live right above?
Well, yeah.
One floor apart.
We do live together, but. we have separate rooms and separate bathrooms.
Okay, so, that's good. You know? I did hear you share a therapist. So,
yeah, we did share a therapist, but we eventually got our own. But
that's
for the first
probably
year, we shared a therapist. It was weird. He would go to the therapist, and then I would go an hour later, and we'd walk out. Right. Like, this is not how it's supposed to be.
Given that you said you are maybe not as thrilled with your last or your first, you know, hour special, have you thought about what you would want to do for your next hour special?
Every day.
We try to think, we think about it, we talk about it, we're trying to like conceptualize it. And, you know, every day, you know, we're thinking about it. But, you know, it's, we don't want it, we want to take a different approach that we took from the last one, where it was like, we're doing a collection of different jokes, and then we kind of put it all together, try to find some theme, and then we record it. I think this time around, we want to make sure our themes are clear. We want to make sure our thesis is clear. And when I'm seeking clarity this time. I want to make sure, I mean, obviously, you know, with stand-up, it's going to be messy, and you're going to be grappling with different ideas, but I just want to have a clearer intention with this one. And so it's required me to like do a lot of research, do some soul searching, and to try to figure out like what approach out we want to take with our next one.
Yeah,
I don't want to speak for you, Kitty.
No, it's the same thing. Like it's been a deep dive. Like we went down to Berkeley, we've gone down to just different comedy spots just to like understand the nature of comedy. I mean, listening to the greats, writing every day and hitting the cellar. We got to work with Babiglia on the road. Just trying to do different things to prepare ourselves for it. We want to tell one piece. Like we want it to feel like a piece, like a feature, like a big film. We don't want to like make it seem like a loose collection of ideas. So I think for our next special, we're going to really like hone in on the themes and the structure and the.
Do you know what that story is? I mean, that is something that Mike Birbiglia is known for. Like you said, like he really does, you know, he's like a storyteller. He tells his shows are one big piece, even if there are different bits along the way. Do you know what the big theme or story that you want to focus on is?
Yeah, I think it's about our relationship as forged in trauma and how we're dealing with that trauma in different phases of our lives. So we start in Newark and we go to, you know, law school, and then we're in Hollywood, and then we're back to Brooklyn. So it's just like our journey with our codependency. I think that's and our journey with drugs and alcohol. I think that would be the big idea. But obviously, we're going to tell little stories about from our childhood.
Codependency is a pretty good title.
Pretty good title. It's a good title. I like codependency, but that's what we're planning.
That's cool. You said you kind of you moved away from Hollywood, you moved back to New York, but you have this, you know, this movie that has all these Oscar nominations. Now you have at least three that I've seen major film projects in the works. So can we talk a little bit about those? I mean, and how you're thinking about them, you know, in relation to your feelings about that whole system.
What's crazy is, man, we were in Hollywood, and in our opinion, we left New York in 2015, right after our sketch show got canceled. Big rest in peace, Friends of the People. But we left right after we escaped from New York after Friends of the People got canceled, and we're like, let's go to Hollywood. And in that time, we met Erica. We met we were homies with Lorne Miller and Will, and we had known Judd since 2012. So we go to Hollywood thinking one of these movies we'll figure some shit out. And so we're auditioning, we're pitching, and things are just going like it's not going very well. In that time, we're pitching Judas too. So we're doing all this shit, and then by 2018, I think we finally closed the Judd deal.
And this is a movie with Judd Apatow that's semi autobiographical. Is that
right?
The gist?
So we've been working on that. We've been working on the Judd film since 2013, 2014, just trying to figure out, okay, what story can we tell to sort of turn into a vehicle for Judd to produce and potentially direct. And it's a process with Judd. You know, you have an idea, you break the story down, you further break the story down, then you take a shot at writing a script, and then you write multiple other drafts of the script, and it's like lengthy. But he also like, he's pushing us to like probe a little deeper and go deeper and deeper, try to get to that messy part and talk about the dark stuff. So like, that was a challenge in and of itself. But while we're working on that script, we're trying to figure out Judas. We're working with Lorne Miller to try to figure out a film idea. And, you know, we're working with Seth MacFarlane trying to figure out ideas. So it's like...
That's a lot to do at once.
Yeah, you're just trying to make something happen, you know.
But none of it was like it was all nebulous. Like we hadn't really secured any of the deals. We hadn't gone to the studios to pitch the ideas. It was just like development. And we were just like, right, whatever. We're not really getting paid, but that's not why we're here. We're here to fucking become our goal going to Hollywood was to become better storytellers. Like we wanted to be in the machine, learn how they make their stories so that we can adopt tactics and apply it to a more independent way of telling stories. So we felt it was necessary for us to learn the ins and outs of Hollywood. It almost broke us, but it was definitely worth the education. But then I think around 2019, that's when Kevin died, and that's when like we were like, fuck Hollywood. Like we were like, man,
Kevin Barnett,
rest in peace, homie. He died. He moved from Brooklyn to Hollywood, and that shit just sort of like, I don't know, man. I feel like his death really just sort of illuminated a lot for me, and I couldn't balance my love of it came down to like, do I value my health or do I value my career? Like what's more important? And I decided not to put my career first anymore, where I'm just like drinking to fucking deal with certain shit or doing drugs to deal with certain shit. So I was like, I'm just gonna retreat back to home and try to find myself.
Right. So we left Hollywood and went back to Brooklyn. And just like, we were like, yeah, we gotta get a hold of this shit, because, you know, this Hollywood shit can kill you if you don't, you know, take a step back and like really, really assess shit. So we went back to Brooklyn and just started doing a lot of stand up and kind of took a break from Hollywood. A brief break, but a break nonetheless.
Yeah. And then the movie comes out, and then deals started getting closed, and then we get 6 Academy Award nominations. I'm like, just when you think you're out, they pull you back in. I was like, I'm done. I'm over this. It's over. And then like, no.
Yeah, no, you can't stop now.
No, right, now it's
right,
impossible.
Right, now it's like we're in it.
Do you know which of those projects is sort of like the furthest along, or the next one that's going to actually happen?
I mean, scripts are done, not done, but scripts are, first drafts are done for all of them. But, you know, I think some drafts are further along than other drafts. I'm not going to say which, but I feel like they're all in like a good shape, I would say. They're all in good shape.
It'll be interesting to see, you know, doing the movie with Judd. It sounds like, you know, it's potentially a similar story to the special that you want to do. So how do you think about that in terms of where different things go in stand up versus, you know, the movie that's also about yourselves?
I think they can work in conjunction, only because, you know, with our stand up, it's, you know, a little bit more, you're not dealing with the traditional studio comedy beats. You can be a little bit more, I mean, vulgar and a little bit more personal. I think they, and the film is dealing with our relationship with our father. That's like the big crux of the film. And I think the stand-up is going to be a little bit more broad.
Yeah, definitely a little more comprehensive. I think they'll be complementary. I think that they're going to work well in conjunction with one another. And I think they're going to complement one another.
So have you had to think about who you would want to play your father?
We've had some preliminary discussions. I mean, you know, obviously you're thinking big. It'll be ideal if you can get Denzel, but it's like, you know, when the last time Denzel
that was the first night and name that came to my mind too.
Of course, you want to go big, but then I'm like, do I want to act against the greatest actor of all time? Like, you know, based on my limitations, I don't know. Maybe somebody will find it, you know, humorous, you know. But Denzel is obviously.
But the second actor, we're like, more Denzel, less Lucas Brody. But it's our story, man. You know,
slowly the movie becomes about him.
Well, he is a better actor, so I understand.
So this podcast is called The Last Laugh. I want to end on the first laugh. And so what I mean is, can each of you talk about the first comedian or piece of comedy that you really remember making you laugh really hard, you know, as a kid or growing up? What was the thing that really sticks out in your memory?
In my memory, my thought was we were in Grandma Alice's place in the Garden Spires, and she was watching Richard Pryor, and I laughed at Richard Pryor.
I don't think I understood that as much as I was too young. I mean, Richard Pryor for sure, but I think Chris Rock's Bring the Pain. That's the one I can remember just laughing like over and over, like Bring the Pain for sure.
Yeah. Bring the Pain. I watch Bring the Pain religiously.
Was it Bigger in Black or Bring the Pain? It was the first one.
Bring the Pain.
That, That's Breed of Pain, right? Yeah, Bigger in Black was the second.
And then can you guys remember the first joke that you told on stage that really worked or really got a big laugh?
The shrooms joke.
Yeah.
It was some version of the shrooms joke.
It was weed before.
It was weed, and it was at the Stress Factory. It was we were doing this graduation show, and we were bombing. It wasn't a bomb, but it was like bad comedy.
Yes, it was.
And it was a bomb. Bad. It was a terrible comedy. And Kenny said something, and it got a bit of a chuckle, and we sort of stuck with it, and it evolved into the shrooms joke that we continue to do. It needs to get out of our set.
Yeah, I mean, look, Seinfeld's still doing material from the 80s, man. He's better than you are, so.
That's fair.
And then we can end on this. What's the last thing that made you laugh really hard? Just something that you've seen recently that you thought was funny? Could be stand-up or something on TV or just on the internet, anything that...
I just watched Bad Trip.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, man. It's all of it's funny. Yeah, I really love Bad Trip. It had me laughing throughout. Yeah, it's great. It's great.
Yeah, I watched, I've been listening to Pryor, and let's see. I'm going to look at my Spotify, see what the last thing I listened to. It was Richard Pryor, Wino Dealing with Dracula. That's the bit I watched.
That's a classic.
Great.
That's a classic.
Yeah.
Well, thank you guys so much for doing this. This was really funny and fascinating, and it's great to meet you and hear your story. And again, congrats on the nominations. It's incredible.
Oh, thank you, man. This was awesome. This was a great conversation, man. I really, really had a good time.
Great. I appreciate it.
Sorry if I got too deep, man.
No, that was good. I like deep. I like deep. Oh man, a huge thank you to Keith and Kenny Lucas for that very deep conversation. They are just very cool, and I'm honestly honored that they let me hang out with them for an hour. Judas and the Black Messiah is currently playing in theaters, if that's an option for you. And with any luck, it will be back on HBO Max very soon. I can't vote for the Oscars, but if I could, they'd definitely have my vote. If you want to support The Last Laugh, please help us out by leaving a rating and review on Apple Podcasts. We want as many people to hear this show as possible, and you can help by spreading the word and sharing it with your friends. You can find me on Twitter at Matt Wilstein and at thedailybeast.com. And if you're not already, please follow at Last Laugh Pod on Instagram, where you can see photos and videos from all of our episodes. The Last Laugh is distributed by Acast for The Daily Beast, with audio production by Jesse Cannon. Our theme music is by Claude, who you can find on Instagram at claude.mp3. You can find this show every week on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to podcasts. And as always, you can find show notes and highlights from each episode on thedailybeast.com. See you next week.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news! Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.